أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Respected viewers, welcome to today's show. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The UK is a country that prides itself on freedom of expression, a country that prides itself on freedom of belief and freedom of speech. It is a country that says there should be no such discrimination. So we have laws out on discrimination against gender, discrimination against disabilities, discrimination against sexual orientation and faith. However, we find that in fact the papers are full of examples of where women are still trying to break what is called the glass ceiling, where women and men are doing exactly the same job, but men are actually earning a higher wage. And so it kind of like feels that these papers do exist, these policies do exist, but in fact it is a tick box event. Today, you know, we're going to look at this country that prides itself on giving us this freedom of expression and look at the experiences of both of my guests today and how they have felt in their ability to have this freedom of expression, be it in wearing the hijab or through the Islamic practices. Today with me I have Sister Amina Taqi, who is currently studying her undergraduates at Kingston University, and Sister Mehfish Mirza, who is a qualified journalist and has also worked in the Middle East as well as the UK. Assalamu alaikum. So Sister Amina, if I can start with you. One of the arguments against wearing the hijab in the West is that we no longer as women have any type of fear, that we're in a country that actually gives us rights, and consequently we don't actually need to wear the hijab. You find that society has evolved from pre-Islamic Arabia. You know, women now have been given rights not only by Islam, but we've been given rights by secular society. And so some use this argument and say you don't need to wear hijab, in fact I don't need to wear hijab, and they then use this as an excuse to not wear hijab. What are your views on this?
I would personally disagree with them, first of all, and hijab has got a place in our society, whether it was 1,400 years ago, whether it is now, whether it is here in the UK or it is in the Middle East. It has a place, and it was ordered upon us to wear it to protect us. It's for our own benefit. It forces our colleagues, whether at university or at work, to judge us by our knowledge, how we talk, what we talk, and our point of view, rather than how we dress or how fashionable we are or our makeup. So I think it has got a place here in society.
Do you have any experiences of where you've actually thanked God that actually I'm glad that I'm in the hijab in this situation?
Many a times. I think it's one of the big blessings in my life that we don't appreciate enough. And I went to a sixth form where it was Christian and English people. I was the only hijabi Muslim woman there. And after 2 years of both good and bad experiences, I realised that it is a blessing that we really don't notice as much. It draws that line between the opposite gender that you can't cross that line. You have to respect me because of the way I dress, because the way I talk. And obviously if I wasn't wearing the hijab or dressed in a certain way, people would just cross that line and, you know, start joking about. And
I personally think that I find it quite ironic that a lot of the time women who don't wear hijab are fighting for equal rights and fighting to always be equal to men and to be recognised for their intelligence. Mm-hmm. And yet they are giving off signals which are quite on the contrary, quite the opposite really. You know, their dress code could be quite provocative or quite, some men may find, you know, really alluring. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of look at us and they think, oh my goodness, what's happened? You know, you just have no fashion zone going on. But I don't agree with I've been on that side as well. Yani, obviously I was still very modest when I didn't do hijab, but I felt that, I see the huge difference. I get so much respect when I talk to anyone now, male and female colleagues. The respect level is just completely different. And you know, when they talk to you, they actually listen to what you're saying, and it's always sister this, sister that. It's not like, you know, they don't look at you as a potential for whatever. And you know, I've been in a situation where, you know, I'm married and it doesn't matter to people, and they will still try and say things and you think to yourself, but I'm married, what is wrong with you? Do you not see that? But that's when I didn't have the hijab. So with the hijab, it's a completely different ball game, and I felt that difference because I, you know, it's only recently, in the last many years, that I started to do this properly. So I would, you know, I don't believe that you need to be dressed in a certain way, in a Western way, to gain that respect. I think with the hijab, and this is what I always say to people, that, you know, your mind is speaking, not anything else.
Definitely, because it's almost saying that, you know what, you won't judge me by my fashion sense, you won't judge me by the colour, the length of my hair, you won't judge me by anything else other than my intellectual capability to do the job that is at hand.
Yeah. If someone can love you for this, then they would probably love you forever, because they you know, it's like they're seeing your inner person, and, you know, they're speaking to you because they like the way you are as a human being, as opposed to the way you look, which, you know, looks fade over time. You may not feel that you're attractive when you're like 70 or 60, but if they like you as a person, then obviously that connection will hopefully, inshallah, stay.
The ironic stance is that those people that say, actually, I don't actually need to wear hijab in this country because I'm free and I have rights, yet we live in a country that actually objectifies women. You know, to sell a car, to sell anything, the medium that they use is via a woman. And so it's rather ironic that, you know, I want to de-veil myself because I have rights, but I want to live in a society and then claim equal rights in a society that actually objectifies
them. I don't think they're aware of what's going on. I think there's some kind of like, it's almost like it's like they're in a trance, or they've been hypnotized by society in a certain way. They don't realize that they're being used in a certain way. And, you know, I see it with teenage girls. I think you must have seen it when you were at uni. It's really sad that they're made to think they have to look a certain way to be attractive, to get any kind of respect or recognition from females and from males. And I think that's really tragic, that, you know, if you're not looking a certain way, you're nothing.
Definitely. Just the other day, I was overhearing a conversation, and one girl was complaining to her friend how her nose was too big, her voice wasn't nice, how she hates her ears, how her hair isn't nice enough. And I was thinking, like, these young 13-year-olds who have got their whole life in front of them are already hating themselves because of how they look, because of what society wants you to look like. And that would definitely affect them when they're older.
I was the magazine editor of a women's lifestyle magazine in the Middle East for many, many years. And I have seen the effect that these images have on young girls. They become anorexic, they become bulimic, they want to be a size 0, size 6, or size 10. Why? Because in the magazines you've got these beautifully airbrushed models with their perfect pouts and, you know, perfect noses and everything, but that's not reality.
The truth of the matter is they've all been photoshopped, haven't they, to look
better? Yeah, airbrushed, exactly. Photoshopped, airbrushed, maybe the hips have been reduced a bit. Now they have, but obviously back in the day it wasn't like that, but, you know, increasingly you'll see them with their flawless complexion. It's very rare that, you know, you find the perfect person. You look at them in real life and you're like, oh my god, is that you, really? But it's sad that these role models are being projected into your homes and into your, you know, into your minds, and you think that's perfection, and you're killing yourself to aspire to that.
You're constantly like trying to like aim for a goal. The only problem is they keep moving the yardstick. So it's like, first we had anti-wrinkle creams, now we have Botox, and we have, I don't know, what and what people do to themselves.
Well, I think you have a right to do what you want. That's entirely your own prerogative, you know. If you want to get Botox, then good luck to you. But what I don't like is society telling me that I should be, you know, this size 10 brunette with, you know, perfect nose, perfect mouth, perfect everything, and that is what's going to give me value in society. I'm sorry, I think that's a load of rubbish. So, you know, I think that is what causes issues when I see stuff like that. It drives me nuts.
And at young ages, you were saying that it affects people's self-esteem.
Yeah, and when they see people like that, whether it's, especially the Muslims, they want to be like that, but also wear the hijab, and you get a mixed view of what hijab is. People don't realise the true essence of hijab and how liberating it is. At the same time, trying to be at size 10, fashionable, full of makeup, but covering your hair as well.
I guess there's no problem if you're doing it for yourself. And I guess that's what the hijab allows. It's like, I will do it, and I will do it because I want to do it, but not because I want to do it to kind of fit some sort of society definition of what I should be. So the fact that, you know, I adorn the hijab doesn't mean that I can't be fashionable, doesn't mean that I don't have rights, doesn't mean that, you know, I can't fix my hair, my extensions, whatever it is. But what hijab is saying is that actually you will be judged for your intellectual value, and everything that goes on underneath is up to you, and it's down to you. So this whole notion of I don't need to wear hijab because I'm trying to conform, you know, that I'm in a society that offers me rights, actually means that I fall into the trap of trying to conform to another society's ideals.
Well, the need to wear hijab is very simple. It's like you mentioned earlier on, it's in the Quran, it's been commanded. It's not something which you have a choice about, really. So it's your level of iman, I think. If you have that level of iman, you will understand the essence and the importance of it and the value of it. If you don't, then you'll just think, yeah, I don't need to wear hijab. It, you know, I say this because at one point I was the same, you know, and I'm not ashamed to talk about my experience, because I want people to understand that I'm not just saying this from one side. You know, when I didn't used to wear hijab, which is a long time ago, I used to think to myself, well, I dress modestly, I don't talk to, like, you know, mahrams, and, you know, I keep within my limits, and so what's the big deal? You know, I don't wear revealing clothes. But it's only when you wear it that you understand how amazing it is, and you actually do feel empowered by it. And it's something you can't describe to people. They have to understand it and go through it themselves.
Definitely. And I quite love the experiments that go on out there where women go, oh, we're going to try the hijab for a day, and they come back and there are articles going, actually, I now get it. I get what these guys are talking about.
Yeah.
So if we move on to our next question, Sister Amna, starting with you, do you think through your own experiences that this country, although glorified for its liberal views, is well informed on Islam and Islamic religious practice to offer you the freedom that you require to be the Muslim that you are?
Talking about the average Western citizen here, I don't think they are well informed about it. As I was saying, I went to a white, filled with white English, a college, and being part of that experience for 2 years, I found it quite difficult to fit in, but then again, the average teacher, most teachers and students respected me for who I am, and although there were quite racist comments from ignorant people, so I think in terms of in terms of freedom, it's got both sides of
it. So this wasn't actually too long ago, because you only just started university.
Yeah.
So sixth form for you was literally the academic year that's just finished.
The last 2 years, yeah.
And so you faced some.
And it was quite funny, because it was a sixth form here in London, mm-hmm. where you would think that it's quite a mixed society. But as I said, I was the only Muslim who covered in that school, and was 700 sixth form people, sixth form college students. So it was quite weird. But then again, people respect you for who you are.
Yeah, I know that, like, for example, my niece, she has a friend who is in a private school, and her friend was reaching the age of 9, and her mum was talking about, okay, now she's going to start wearing hijab. So the parent kind of goes into school and goes, no, my daughter's going to start wearing hijab. She spoke to her daughter's friend's parents, and her parents went, don't do that. And they were like, why? She goes, because she will never get the same opportunities as somebody else if she wears a hijab. I think my friend was gobsmacked. She was like, where does this actually exist? And, you know, for me, my racist experiences happened up north, because I was one Muslim family in the school that I was in. And, you know, sometimes, you know, Channel 4 shows documentaries about how this racism exists further up north because we're less cosmopolitan. But your experiences actually say that, no, London actually isn't as cosmopolitan as it likes to say that it is. Sister Mavish, would you like to share some light?
I think that through my own experiences, I haven't to this day, thank God, alhamdulillah, experienced any kind of racism without my hijab and with my hijab. The only experience of racism I had was when I was very, very young, about 8 years old, and I was in junior school in Singapore in a very British school.
Oh, wow.
Where I was just singled out for being not white, for just having a more tanned complexion, I guess. Otherwise, and maybe just a little bit when I was in Surrey in England, again, when very early years of infant school. But funnily enough, growing up, with or without the hijab, I've not experienced anything like that. As far as people being informed about Islam, I think that they're getting there. I don't feel they're 100% informed about it. I think there's still a long way to go. I think that, you know, they probably don't know what the facts are, and they probably don't know what culture. I think there's a lot of culture and religion mixed, which there's that line where, you know, it's blurred. And so they may have had some Asian friends at school whose mum used to wear dupatta, you know, on the head, which is just like a, not a chador, but, you know, just a thinner version of it. And they don't do hijab, and, you know, they just know, okay, they're Muslim, they don't eat pork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, they're Muslims, they don't drink, they're really boring. So, you know, at the moment, I still think the average white person maybe is still not that well informed.
But in terms of being able to practice your religion openly, I know that, for example, my niece has just turned 9, and obviously Salat is now wajib upon her, and so sometimes it's a necessity that she prays at school. So she asks, is there a prayer room? Yes, there is. It's the library. No problem, she can pray. But there's no idea which way she has to face, so the teacher says to her, oh, you have to face southeast. That doesn't help a child in any way whatsoever. So yes, as a school, I want to be able to accommodate that this Muslim child wants to pray. But how well informed am I? And how, I mean, and what I'm trying to gauge is, be it through your peers, be it through your children, are they actually able to freely practice? I mean, looking at the times that we have now, we're approaching winter time now, and, like, you know, you'll see pictures of people going, oh, look, there's a person praying on a train platform. But that's really because they don't have a choice, because prayer rooms aren't readily available. So have you or your children or your siblings had any experiences where actually practicing to be a Muslim is a little bit harder here?
If I compare it to the Middle East, obviously it's more difficult because, you know, over there you've got prayer rooms and, you know, it's Adhan and, you know, wudu places. But then, you know, being a Muslim isn't about everything being available to you. It's the challenges that you face to able to bow down to your creator.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously this country isn't going to be equipped, but I still think it's allowing us to practice more than maybe you would in other countries. I've lived in many countries, and, you know, I know for a fact that in Pakistan there's a lot of internal prejudices within the community of Muslims, and I also know how they feel about other faiths. So you wouldn't, I'm sure Pakistan or other countries like that would have an issue with loads of churches springing up or loads of synagogues springing up. I'm sure there would be problems. You know, here we're at least allowed to a certain extent to practice our faith. I don't think you should go in with the mentality that, oh, if I wear hijab, I will not get this and I will not get that. I used to work for the body shop and I had my hijab. I went in for my job interview with the hijab, and I was customer facing. I was actually on the shop floor. I just did it for fun for a while because I wanted to just, you know, just not do anything stressful. And everyone I met in the shop, whoever came in, all the customers that came in, they were very, very nice. I was shocked, and I was quite surprised actually, because that area that I was working was predominantly like Jewish people, and I actually had ladies coming in saying, oh, you know, I really like the way you've done your scarf, it's so nice, and so tell me something. They would actually ask me questions about Islam. Can you tell me, is this right, is this correct? And, you know, so if you go in with the mindset that, you know, you're doing this for your creator, and then, you know, he will help you, he will guide you. And if you go in for a job and you don't get it because of this, then, you know, it means that it wasn't meant to be.
Definitely. Today we've been discussing people's personal experiences of hijab in a country that claims to give us freedom of rights and freedom of expression, and we've just been analysing whether being a Muslim in this country has given us what we need to do. And as so far we've established that actually, you know what, we expect things to be easy for us, but in actual fact that the whole struggle, the whole jihad of being a Muslim is trying to actually be a Muslim. So inshallah we'll continue this discussion after the break, so please join us then. Assalamu alaikum and welcome back to today's show, where we're looking at our freedom of being able to express ourselves as Muslim and our personal experiences with interacting with the hijab. Thank you for joining us, and I'd like to welcome back my guests, Sister Mehfish Mirza and Sister Amina Taqi. Sister Amina, going to you first, because right now you're studying nutrition, right? So you're going to have a very public facing role when you actually graduate at the end. So the question that I pose to you is, in a professional setting, which you will be eventually, inshallah, it is seen as rude to not offer your hand when somebody offers a hand for a handshake. There are some schools of thought that say, well, actually, if my intention is not one of lust, then the handshake is okay. There are others that say, no handshaking allowed, and then, therefore, as a result of that, you could be perceived as being rude. What is your take on this?
Just the other day at university, we were meeting our lecturers, and the lecturer was a man, and he was shaking hands with everybody, and he put his hand forward, and I immediately stepped back, smiled, and apologized for not being able to shake his hand. And the lecturer was completely understanding, but I must say he was quite confused, because there were other Muslim women in hijab who shook his hand. So he looked at me like, I'm sort of, I understand and I respect your views, but the other women shook my hand, but you didn't. And unfortunately, I didn't have the time to explain to him, and he had to move to the next person and shake his hand. But most men are understanding, and they respect your views. I know my mother, when she graduated from university, although it was in the Middle East, from college, it was from in the Middle East, and because men are used to women not shaking their hands, so she just put her hand on her chest and, you know, bow down in front of him, just get the certificate and move forward. So it depends on your place, and most men are fine with it, unless you do it like in a rude way. And but if you do it nice and, you know, smile and apologize for it, they'll be completely understanding.
I think this is where the issue lies, that there is no uniformity. There are some that will shake, some that won't shake. Mm-hmm. I remember that at my friend's graduation, there was a friend of mine that went around for ages trying to find a pair of gloves. I was like, why are you trying to find gloves? Like, why are you wearing gloves in the middle of the summer? She goes, because he's going to go shake my hand. I was like, so tell him you don't want to shake it. And it kind of like feels that people don't want to say, no, I'm not going to shake your hand. So they're trying to find loopholes and, you know, buying gloves and, you know, going through all of this. And I remember that when I was at work, I did this Black Leadership Development course. And I remember that this handshaking topic came up, and I said to him that, oh, I met someone who was offering me something, and he went to shake my hand, and I went, sorry. And the first thing he did was raise an eyebrow, and he goes, why did you apologize for your beliefs? He goes, don't apologize. He goes, it is what it is. He goes, don't apologize for them. So, Sister Yasmin, I mean, obviously, you've worked here in the UK, you've worked in Dubai, so I think your perspective on this will be an interesting one.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it's difficult sometimes, because you could be meeting some really high-profile people, and you could also be treading on a very sort of dodgy ground where they may not give you a job, they may not allow you to interview them based on the fact that you're not willing to shake hands, because people can get offended. But obviously, the people who live in the Middle East or are from Iran or Iraq and places like that tend to understand. Having said that, my boss in Dubai was incredibly understanding as well. You know, he understood that, you know, this is something which Muslim women generally do not wish to do. You come across some who are quite happy to shake, and obviously, you know, they don't have a problem with it. And then you're standing there going, wait, hang on a second, I'm not going to... But it's totally down to how you conduct yourself. And, you know, I do the same as you. I just put my hands on my chest and sort of bow down almost to say that, look, this is my extension of a handshake, so take it or leave it, really. But it's about how you come across. You know, if you come across as being all kind of uppity, then it makes them feel uncomfortable. But if you give them a smile and say, look, this is as good as it gets, then, yeah. It is difficult. It's a very difficult decision to make, but, you know, why should you be sorry for what you believe in?
But what is your stance on this whole, well, it's not lust, I'm not touching through lust, and consequently that it should be okay as a result?
Yeah, your intention, Islam, is everything. It's very true. But then at the same time, you know, it's somebody who's a non-mahram, and that really is the bottom line, I guess, mm-hmm. for me.
Yeah, I think if it was a man, as in like a non-Muslim man, they not saying all Muslim men have the intention of lust, but maybe people in the West don't see a handshake as part of lust. But this is, it goes back down to the fact that this is what we believe in. And
actually, my cousin, if I can just add, had this discussion with me just a few days ago, and she said to me that she can now understand why, you know, you're not supposed to shake hands, because she said recently, she just recently started her job, so up until 3 years ago she wasn't doing it, and she went for a job interview, and the interviewer shook her hand, and he held onto her hand, and she felt really uncomfortable, and she said, "Oh, I didn't like that," and you know, he was almost. It was as if he had other intentions, but she felt, and this is without, you know, she wasn't doing her job then, and she said, "I felt really uncomfortable, and I didn't like it." Now, some girls might like it, but obviously that was, you know, you don't know, but she didn't, and she said, "I can see why, even by a handshake, there's this, you know, this connection." Mm. And she said to me, I would never want to do it now, ever.
I remember I used to work for a government organization, and I was like, we don't have, I mean, we're a country that says no discrimination, freedom, 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 freedom. And so I was like, where are the papers that say, for example, that actually she should, you know, if there is a Muslim woman and she does request a meeting room to pray in, that she should be offered one? Or the fact that, you know, you shouldn't offer your hand to mm-hmm. shake it. Mm-hmm. And they said, "Oh, actually, do you know what? Why don't you write them up?" So I said, "Fine." So we wrote papers on Salah, we wrote papers on fasting, we wrote papers on the handshake. And I remember my manager saying to me, "But what if she's the one that offers her hand?" And I said, "Well, then that's her prerogative,
yeah.
And that's down to her. But you shouldn't be the one that offers it." And he says, "Fine, no problem." So we write this paper. It becomes national document. And then the CEO of our company, the chief executive officer, changes. And he comes down to our office and he goes, "Hi, you must be Sarah." I said, "Yeah." And he stuck his hand out. And for a second, I stood there and I was like, "What?" So I continued talking to him and I ignored his hand. He goes, "Aren't you going to shake my hand?" I said, "I think you're forgetting that I was the one that actually wrote your paper that says you won't be offering your hand unless I offer it to you." And it's like, sometimes I feel that even though we say that there's going to be no discrimination and that we're going to have these freedoms, we're going to have these rights, and even the companies are saying, "Yeah, we'll accommodate," it feels a little bit like a tick box events. It's just like, okay, yeah, we've done it. We've met our equal opportunities. We have a paper. It says that they'll be free. But the reality of it is something completely different. I mean, I don't know whether you've experienced the same, be it at uni, be it in your professional fields, any kind of experiences?
Not in terms of that, no. But I do understand why some people would want to be progressive about it and give a handshake just to see what you
your
do
reaction.
And yeah, and whether you, well, I guess maybe they're trying to see if what you've written you actually do.
So maybe was just testing me on me and my belief system. That's interesting. And you know, so at your sixth form you were the only muhajjaba, you're the only person that wore hijab. Were you able to pray freely? Were you given a space to pray? Or
in terms of winter, I've got a twin brother and we used to go to the sixth form, and we both went up and asked the father at the school, because it was a Church of England school, mm-hmm. and we asked him if we could have a prayer room, because they've got a church that they go to every twice a week in the morning, mm-hmm. and we just wanted it for the winter time because we couldn't make it in time, and he automatically said, "Yes, we've done that before, but it's going to take a while." So we waited 2 weeks, still we didn't get a reply from him, so we went and asked him again, and they were able to provide us a room, which is more like a cupboard, for 10 minutes every lunchtime. 10 minutes is enough to pray, but I guess we were really appreciative the fact that we, as two Muslims in the whole school, they were able to provide us a room to pray in. And the same thing happened the next year, although they did take even longer this time. They used the excuse of, "We don't have enough rooms at lunchtime," even though they don't use classrooms for lunchtime. And we did have quite I think two Muslim teachers, and they offered us their rooms to pray in.
That's nice.
Yeah, during lunchtime. So it's, I guess you have to be understanding that it is a Christian sixth form school and sixth form. So, but they did provide it at the end of the day.
No animosity in terms of from the school and the fact that you wanted to practice hijab on a daily basis.
No, although they did say that abaya isn't allowed.
Interesting.
You should ask them, what do priests wear then?
Yeah.
Send them to me. what were you asking?
In regards to, you know, have you had any experiences where actually practicing has been a little bit difficult? I mean, I was comparing it to me being in an office where it was kind of like a tick box event.
Yeah.
You know, you'll have a prayer room and you'll have this, but the reality of it is something quite different, because now you using my office actually means you're obstructing me from having a meeting.
I think because I started hijab probably a lot later in life, I didn't face those kind of obstacles in terms of, you know, being judged on my appearance at the time. But I did ask for prayer rooms. I used to work for an investment bank,
mm-hmm.
In the city. And during Ramadan and just generally, because I always did want to do my salah and my namaz was always, you know, something I had that I got to do this. It's not, I'm not just because I don't do hijab at the time, it didn't mean that I didn't pray. And I did ask for prayer rooms, and actually I was quite lucky to get them, although they would look at me and go, oh, you pray. So it was a very sort of like, oh, but you don't look like, you know, the others. Like, as if like, well, what do you mean? I, you know, it's like the others. It's like, oh, right, okay. But I do pray, so it was a shock to them. But they were fine with it. You know, the fact that I would say things like, well, I'm sorry, I don't go to pubs on a Friday. It's mm-hmm. just not doing it, not happening. Oh, okay then, so we'll try and hold the Christmas dinner in a restaurant for you. Yeah, but does the restaurant serve alcohol? Because I won't be going to it then. They'd be like, what, do you want us to do it at McDonald's then? You know, so, I would just say to them, guys, go ahead with it, it's fine. But one of my managers was really nice. He said, look, if you don't want to do that, we'll hold our Christmas dinner where we want to hold it, but we'll also do a party in the office, so you know you don't feel left out or anything like that. So I think alhamdulillah I have been always blessed with people who have accommodated me to my beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
On the contrary, I had a very bad experience at university where we got a prayer room. I went in to pray, and while I was praying, someone picked up my sajdaga, my mor, and threw it away.
Oh wow.
So then after I finished my namaz, I walked out, and I didn't know who it was, because obviously I was in sujood at the time, or I was about to go in, and I've kind of figured out who it was, just kind of by the looks I was getting, and I challenged this person. He was a guy, and I don't think he ever did that to me again, let's put it that way. I had a very deep conversation with him, and I, you know, sort of stood my ground, and I said to him, you know, how dare you? You're a Muslim, how could you do that? And obviously he came back with a different story. So I've actually had problems within Muslims, mm-hmm. as opposed to non-Muslims, but that's my personal experience. I know not everyone had the same experience. When I started doing the hijab, one lady said to me, oh my God, what have you done? You know, you ruined your face. She was Muslim.
Wow. I guess it's really a little bit like we're trying to, although no one is going to say no, we need to kind of be out there and we need to educate a little bit and say, you know, yes, this is allowed, no, this isn't allowed. So for example, when I was younger, you know, you kind of get these retail jobs, and I remember saying to my manager, I need someone to pray, and went, can you pray in the toilet? I'm like, really? Like, did you really just say to me that the toilet would be sufficient? And they were like, I guess not. And I went, no. She went, okay, fine. And it's like, yeah, we want you to have your, you know, freedom of expression, mm-hmm. but you need to educate us at the same time, because we don't know. Like, we don't want to say no, but we just don't know. So carrying on with today's discussion, hijab obviously is mandated on a girl from the age of 9. Now, obviously, I remember when I was 9, and now, you know, I'm very much over that age. Hijab now means something more to me. At 9, I don't think I quite understood mm-hmm. it as well as I do now. So I guess my question to you is, How have you grown into this hijab? How have you grown into it through your own experiences?
I was fortunate enough to have my parents' influence in terms of the hijab. Since a young age, even before the age of 9, I could see Muslim women around me, both from my mom, their friends, family members who wore the hijab. So from a young age, I would look up to them and be like them. And I think the significance of the age of nine is just amazing, because at the age of nine you're still under the influence of your parents. Even if you don't fully understand the concept of hijab at that age, you just want to be like your mother, you just want to be like your auntie. But whereas, let's say that hijab was mandated at the age of 13, you're at that rebellious age when you don't want to listen to your parents, so that might cause you not to wear the hijab from that age. Or even if you're like older, from the age of 18 or 20, you've grown up without hijab. So I think the significance of the age of nine is quite important. And from your perception of hijab from the age of nine does change. I think now I realise how much of a blessing it is in my life, and the respect I gain from normal people just out in the street. And I would never let go of it.
Definitely.
Alhamdulillah.
Sister.
My daughter, alhamdulillah, decided to wear the hijab at a much earlier age than what I obviously started, and that was one of my biggest, you know, on my wish list, so to speak, on my nice Islamic wish list that I have. I wanted her to understand the concept of it. And, you know, I think what you said about environment and having role models is so important, to have the correct role models. You shouldn't advocate something if you're not practicing it. So practice what you preach. If you are telling your children to, you know, read their namaz, do their salah on time, then you should be doing it as well. If you're explaining the value of hijab to your daughter, then you should be doing it as well, and you should be doing it in the manner that you'd like her to do it. So, and the age nine that you just said, is it important? Because at 9, 10, 11, 12, I think they're still very much in awe of their mothers and their aunties, and then when they get older, it's very much about trying to fit in and looking cool.
It's a bit like, you know, Imam Ali says that, you know, we split the child's like development in three stages, 0 to 7, 7 to 14, and gone 14, it's upon them. So you're right, because children do imitate, you know, the environment is important. And I remember for me, actually, when I started to wear hijab, it was more daunting, A, because I was up north, B, because I was the only Muslim. There was no one around. There was no one around that wore it, and I was the only one that stuck out like a sore thumb. And I kind of like was like, and some people use this argument today in terms of burqa and niqab, and they're going, the whole idea is to not draw attention to you. All you're doing is drawing attention to yourself, and therefore you shouldn't be wearing it. I kind of find it a little bit of a weak argument.
But you're not drawing it in a provocative way.
Definitely.
That argument is only if you're drawing attention and you're actually getting, you know, you're arousing somebody's interest in you. This way you're following the command of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told you. And like, subhanAllah, look, you know, we were commanded at nine to wear hijab, and only Allah has all the knowledge of what the bodily changes are of a girl at nine, and, you know, her mental state. And that's why he commanded it for that age, because it's in the hadith, I suppose, isn't it, more than anything else, that, you know, that's the age that it's recommended, and they should, because by 13, 14, they will have a mind of their own and they'll be completely different. So
even the hadith, it goes back as far as saying that, you know, praying and fasting, actually start them at 7. And then so that once it's like 9, because otherwise it's an alien concept. All of a sudden at 9, you're stapling a scarf on my head, you're telling me I can't wear shorts, I can't wear skirts, I can't wear this.
Some people say women should have a choice, though. They say that, you know, they should be old enough to decide whether they want to wear a hijab or not. I've had that, a lot of mothers saying that to me, that, oh, you know, you should have given her a choice. Why have you told her? I said, I haven't told her, I advised her.
But this is just it, though, isn't it? It's like, people are like, oh, but you should have given them a choice. But it's like, no, there is no choice, yani. Like, there was la ikraha fi din. You don't have to accept the religion of Islam, but once you've accepted it, this is it.
Yeah.
The laws are what they are. Yeah, totalitarian all the way. Any last comments from either of the guests in terms of personal experiences, in terms of
hijab? I think it's the best thing I did, and I wish I'd started it sooner. I think I always wanted to wear it, but sometimes the support is not there. You were lucky that you were in that environment. I think around me, I wasn't around many people who did hijab, and it was not considered something which was essential to your faith. It was more about reading your salah on time. So yeah, maybe that's what it was. But I would never, I wish I'd done it earlier, is all I can say.
I think girls need to understand the true concept of hijab more, and for them to have supportive role models in their lives to look up to, and it is a blessing that hasn't been appreciated enough in our daily lives.
Definitely. So I'd like to thank my guests for joining me today in today's discussion, and you, the viewers, for joining us also. What we've gathered from today is, yes, hijab is a personal struggle, and that, yes, we do live in a country that is liberal. It is a country that isn't going to deny you, but at the same time, you have that role in A, gaining those rights, and B, educating the masses. We are ambassadors of the religion of Islam. Allah has set out these laws in order to protect us and only us. We hope that you found today's show beneficial. I thank you for joining us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.